This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. On January 4th this year, Congressman Mel Watt was named the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. That's a group of 43 African-American members of Congress. In his new leadership position, Congressman Watt will be a high-profile voice for the efforts of the caucus and for North Carolina. Congressman Mel Watt entered politics as the campaign manager for Harvey Gantt during his successful runs for Charlotte mayor and his unsuccessful races for the U.S. Senate against Jesse Helms. Mel Watt himself was elected from the 12th District, that's now between Charlotte and the Triad, back in 1992, and he joins us now from his office in Washington. Thanks for being with us today, Congressman.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, you said after President Bush's State of the Union address that the speech fell, and I'm quoting here, woefully short of what the Congressional Black Caucus had hoped to hear. Well, what was it that you hoped to hear?
Well, we had hoped that the president would use the State of the Union address as a kind of a bully pulpit to mobilize and motivate America to work on closing the substantial disparities that we had identified to him in our meeting. The State of the Union address historically has been used by presidents to talk about the things that are valuable, that are high priorities for them, and the president simply didn't do that. I guess he just didn't think that what we were talking about, closing and eliminating disparities, was of that high a value.
You had met with him before his State of the Union speech.
Yes, we had.
Had you really held out much hope that he would say those things in the Union address?
Held out hope. I didn't have any reason to either be encouraged or discouraged about whether that hope was a realistic hope, but you always hold out hope, and you always want the president to say something, and he just didn't measure up.
Okay. One area that you had hoped the president would comment on, as I understand, was racial and ethnic profiling by law enforcement. Talk to me a bit about that. Are you going to make a push from the floor of the Congress to make changes in that?
Well, we are going to make a push in a number of different on a number of different fronts to try to address it. But the problem is so massive because it starts at the police stop stage. It then progresses through the arrest stage. It progresses through the charge stage, through the prosecution stage, through the sentencing stage, and it permeates the whole thing. There are disparities in every area, at every stage. So you've got to try to attack it at every one of those levels.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious. You're a member of Congress, but do you feel as though you've ever been a victim of racial profiling by law enforcement?
Not by law enforcement, no, because I try to stay out of situations where that possibility exists. Actually, I have been, to be honest with you, now that I think about it. We were driving, my district director and I were driving through one of the counties in North Carolina, doing about 2 miles per hour above the speed limit, and all of a sudden there was a police car there. It was just two black men. And there really was no reason for us to be stopped. There were other people who were going the same pace. Yet here we were, all of a sudden, on the side of the road, stopped by the police. That obviously didn't progress to any kind of explosive situation because when the police officer realized who was in the car, he kind of, said, I thought you all were going a little bit too fast, and he kind of got very apologetic about it. But you could see how that single incident could, if allowed to escalate, could result in an arrest, could result in a prosecution for resisting arrest, could result in a sentence where somebody goes to jail. And that, unfortunately, continues to happen in our country.
You have also stated, as head of the Congressional Black Caucus, Mel Watt, that if the president's Social Security reforms, his changes, are adopted, the number of elderly African-Americans who fall into poverty would double. how would that happen? And if you could, for us, make the case for why Social Security ought to be left as it is.
Well, it would happen because disproportionate numbers of African-American citizens rely on Social Security as their only source of income in their advancing years. They don't have any assets outside of Social Security. They don't have any private retirement accounts. And so Social Security is their only means of supporting themselves. And if you started to take any part of that away, that would dump those people into a situation where they are living in poverty. And so statistically, it would just be devastating to us.
Mm-hmm. So in 1969, when the Congressional Black Caucus was formed, there were 13 African-American members of Congress. And after the elections last November, that number went up to 43. That's about 13% of Congress or so. More or less the same percentage of African-Americans in the general population. Is this a sign of progress?
Well, it's about 10% of the...
Forgive me for my math. Okay.
435 as opposed to 43.
Oh, my back-of-envelope math is bad here. I'm sorry.
So, it'd be about 10%.
So we're lower than the general population.
It's lower than the African-American population, but still moving in the right direction, and we picked up four new members in this last election. So we just have to keep pushing that envelope. And you know, the way we push it now is to make sure that that we don't focus so much on the individual members of Congress and their numbers, but making sure that every individual citizen is not intimidated, is not discouraged from voting, and when they do go into the polling place, that their vote actually counts in the outcome. And now we've had two experiences in 2000 and in 2004 that suggest to us that that's not as easy as one would think it is in America, which holds itself up as the gold standard for democracy. Mm. So we are working aggressively on the voting front. We need to get the expiring provisions of the Voting Rights Act reauthorized before they expire in 2007. And so there are a number of challenges in that area, in the voting area.
Mm-hmm. There are also those issues about at the voting place with electronic voting machines. Is that that's a broad issue, not just to those voters who are African-American, but is that something that the CBC, the Congressional Black Caucus, would take up?
Well, we would certainly take it up if they are putting machines without paper trails in predominantly African-American precincts and not putting them in other precincts. We want fairness in this process, and there's some question about whether a paper trail is needed, but I personally believe it would be advantageous to have a paper trail for all balloting, and if the absence of a paper trail fell disproportionately on African-American voters, I think it would further undermine our confidence in the voting process.
Mm-hmm. A moment ago, we were talking about the president's State of the Union address, and you were not happy with that. But during the president's time in the Oval Office, he has appointed the first African-Americans as Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, Secretary of Education. Does President Bush deserve some credit for his efforts at putting African-Americans in his own cabinet?
Well, I think that's something that we applaud him for. I mean, we don't always agree with the people that he's appointing, but they are African-Americans, and he's to be applauded for that. We're not negative about that. What we're looking for is that to have an impact on the policies and ultimately to have an impact on closing these disparities that have persisted throughout our history in this country. And that's we're results oriented a lot more than we're We're process-oriented.
Right. Well, Mel Ott, later in the program, after you leave us, we're going to be discussing the civil rights era and how it's remembered. You grew up in Charlotte in the 60s. You graduated from Yale Law in 1970, practiced law, then got involved in politics. How do you remember the civil rights era here in North Carolina?
Well, I remember it as a time of extreme ambivalence, because there was always elements that wanted to support the status quo, didn't feel like they had the power or the influence to do anything other than support the status quo. And so African Americans were constantly caught in the dilemma, do I get actively involved in the movement, or do I just get involved in it in a more passive way? And so those were difficult times for African Americans who were growing up in that time. A lot of my friends, a lot of my schoolmates and classmates in college went full bore over into the civil rights movement, and a lot of them paid the price of not being able to get their education as a result of that. So you were always constantly facing the dilemma, how much are you going to be involved or how much are you going to be the beneficiary of it? And I feel blessed because I, in many ways, feel like I'm a beneficiary of sacrifices that a lot of my colleagues and classmates were making for me, who made that call in a different way than I did at that time.
Well, Congressman Watt, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
North Carolina Congressman Mel Ott is chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus. When we return to the state of things, our discussion about our remembrance of the civil rights movement. All that ahead on the state of things. This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. The month of February is a notable one in the history of race relations in North Carolina. It was in this month in 1960 that four African-American students from North Carolina A&T sat down at the lunch counter in Greensboro, refusing to leave when they were denied service. And 45 years ago tomorrow, Martin Luther King stood on the steps of the White Rock Baptist Church in Durham and for the first time publicly supported the sit-in demonstrators and their nonviolent methods. While the conventional history of the civil rights movement is steeped in that concept of nonviolence, there was violence too. Consider another February. It's 1971, Wilmington. A boycott gives way to violence, fires and gunshots, two people dead. Nine African Americans and one white woman, who came to be known as the Wilmington Ten, were arrested and then convicted. And so the question is, how do we remember the civil rights era? And has time perhaps dulled our collective memory of the more violent events? We welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862, 1-877-962-9862. Whether you lived through the civil rights movement or you came along after it and are just getting the history now, we welcome your calls. 1-877-962-9862. Well, author Tim Tyson says that we recall the civil rights movement as a, quote, civic celebration that went along unopposed. And that's a memory, he says, that is a self-congratulatory fable. Tim Tyson joins us this hour. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is on leave this semester and is the John Hope Franklin Senior Fellow at the National Humanities Center in RTP. Tim Tyson's recent book, Blood Doesn't Sign My Name, is a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. Welcome to the State of Things. Welcome back, Tim Tyson.
Thank you, Linda. Thanks for having me.
Well, you are giving a public lecture on Thursday that is entitled Miss Amy's Witness, Why the History of the Civil Rights Movement is Mostly Wrong. So tell us about Miss Amy and tell us why you think the history of the civil rights movement is, as you say, mostly wrong.
Well, Miss Amy Womble was a first grade teacher in Jonesboro Heights Methodist Church in Sanford, North Carolina, when my father was a preacher there in 1964. And we had a crisis because my father asked Dr. Samuel Proctor, who was the president of North Carolina A&T and really the leading black preacher of his generation, to come and preach. And then many of the church members had a protest meeting, and they sort of tried to stop this from happening and run my father off of his pulpit, honestly. And Miss Amy, whom everybody revered her, but nobody really knew what she thought about things, and she stood up and sort of shamed everybody and and turned the church around, and we had a real positive experience, actually, with Dr. Proctor's visit. It's one of the stories that I tell in Blood Doesn't Sign My Name. In some ways, it's an archetypal civil rights story because it's about a call on America's conscience and a eloquent black preacher and this kind of turning away from racism and deciding to do what we really knew was the right thing in the first place, which is the kind of story that we tell ourselves about the civil rights movement. It's very much the kind of thing you hear in January on Martin Luther King Day. But in fact, the only problem with that is it bears almost no resemblance to what actually happened in the United States in those years.
And in those years, we're talking here the 60s and 70s?
The 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm. But just to backtrack a bit, she did use logic and persuasion in her
right.
simple
Essentially
story.
A moral witness.
Yeah, she was saying that she'd heard tell of a boy who was hit by a car and he's on the side of the road and a member of the service, a member of the military, stops by and saves the child's life.
Yes.
And it turns out she doesn't tell the race of either of these characters.
Right. So she made an appeal to people's hearts about the irrationality of their views about race. Interestingly, though this is sort of the civil rights story that we grew up telling around my family's kitchen table, we went through far more intense things in Oxford and in Wilmington, where we had violence and murder and arson and really, rage in the streets. So I think in some ways what America is doing with its civil rights history is trying to invent a history that is soothing and politically acceptable and that we can live with and go forward without actually changing anything. And we have a hard time coming to grips with the failure of the civil rights movement, the fact that the enemies of the civil rights movement, for example, George Bush Sr., first ran for public office. His central issue was opposing the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Ronald Reagan, a renowned opponent, he cut his political teeth fighting against the civil rights movement. Jesse Helms really came to public attention, a one-issue candidate in 1972, constantly attacking the civil rights movement. And, Trent Lott from Mississippi, really a candidate from the White Citizens Council. These people ascended to national power, and the narrative that we've told is that the civil rights movement worked when most of the things that Dr. King marched for didn't happen. And in fact, the Dr. King that we talk about every year is essentially someone who didn't exist.
Well, make a case for the history that you think should be taught when, say, students open their books and they get to, the civil rights era in American history.
Well, I think we have to do a couple of things. First, the civil rights movement happened everywhere, and it was essentially local. People in their own communities, people just like you and I, working in their own communities to make this happen. We get this sense that it's somehow was handed down from the federal government, or that great heroes and towering orators and crusaders and saints somehow created this thing, when it was really just a nitty-gritty local movement everywhere at the same time. There was never any place you could call on the phone and they'd say, Civil Rights Movement, may I help you? Because that office didn't exist. Most places Dr. King never went. So we have this series of stories that we tell ourselves that are essentially when the movement reached the front page of the New York Times, all of a sudden history is happening, when in fact, in Wilson and in Oxford and in Fayetteville and all across eastern North Carolina, all of these communities had to win freedom and sit full citizenship with black people on their own. And it was very complicated. We also like an interracial story about it, when in fact most white people were opposed to the civil rights movement. Or were terrified by it. And the white people that you see marching with Martin Luther King on the bridge at Selma are from Wyoming and Minnesota. They're socialists. They're Unitarian seminary students. They're vegetarians and Quakers and sort of offbeat people from around. They're not local people in Selma. White people who were in favor of the civil rights movement in Selma or in Wilmington were terrified to say so. And white people who did that often lost their jobs, for example. So
how long would it...
There's a lot of things that I would say about that, but those are a couple.
Sure. So you're saying that by being quiet, they're being complicit with the status quo. The whites in a lot of these towns, and you're talking about southern towns.
Well, I understand. I'm not trying to be harsh on people, because I understand the circumstances. But we, you know, if you go to your psychiatrist and you tell her you always have done the right thing and you stood up and did things and your high school term paper won the Pulitzer Prize, you know, that may be harmless, but you're not going to get well. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to deal with our current racial situation, then as Congressman Watt eloquently described it, then we have to have an honest confrontation with our own past and where who we are and where we've been, because there's good stuff in there too. You know, it's just that you can't just tell yourself a happy story and expect to get anywhere.
It did evolve, though, did it not? I mean, there were those whites in those places, the Selmas and other towns in the South, and one can say also the North, who did come around. It may not have happened in 1960.
By the time it happened, it was too late.
Too late for what?
Too late for, by the time that most of the white people who came around to supporting some form of what the Civil Rights Movement was after, by that time, we already had, America was already on fire. There had been a backlash forming, and quickly the opposition to the Civil Rights Movement won. You know, President Nixon put together his Southern strategy. George Wallace won in North Carolina in 1968, and then in 72, George Wallace crushed Terry Sanford, our own Terry Sanford. That was all about
in the
race
Democratic
issue. In the Democratic Party in 72, George Wallace ended Terry Sanford's political career, I mean his presidential aspirations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're talking about things were just got more out of control, and we're talking here nonviolence was no longer the method. Alone.
Well, we also, nonviolence is...
By the 60s, there were, in the late 60s, there were riots.
Well, the truth to be told, we like to put these things in different categories, violence and nonviolence, civil rights and black power. But in Birmingham in 1963, which we think of as being the high watermark of nonviolence, you know, 9 blocks of Birmingham were destroyed in rioting, police cars overturned, several people killed. Birmingham... the reason why President Kennedy got on the television on June 11, 1963 and talked about the civil rights bill that he suddenly decided he wanted to put before Congress was because they were afraid a race war was breaking out in Birmingham. They really were. And they were very concerned about the foreign policy implications of that, because we're in a Cold War competition with the Soviet Union for influence in the wider world, and we had had essentially an international political crisis that was created by our domestic race problem. And so nonviolence was an important moral witness. But what it has in common, what sitting at the lunch counter has in common with burning a warehouse, is that both of them are a form of coercion that says you're not going to make any money until you deal with us. Until you make us full citizens, we will not have business as usual. And that is a form of politics and coercion. And it's not just about calling upon the conscience of the person who owns the lunch counter who wants to eat at it, mm-hmm. but is a matter of compelling them to negotiate with you. Martin Luther King said, a riot is the language of the unheard. If you won't hear the sit-in, then things will start catching on fire. And that's always been true, and it's true all over the world. And I think we tell ourselves a kind of happy story about that because we'd like to pretend that we were better than we were.
So in your telling of the civil rights movement, if you were writing the curriculum, mm-hmm. It would be that there was this nonviolent movement, but then there was also violence or this threat of expanded violence that brought more people around. And we're talking the white majority here, mm-hmm. brought the white majority around to recognizing that blacks deserved equal rights.
Right.
And that's how you would tell it.
Yeah.
Does that go back to the old phrase about you can't make an omelet without cracking some eggs?
Well, it's just politics as it happens on planet Earth among flawed human beings who don't do, you know, people don't do the right thing. They do the thing they have to do to get through the situation. You know, nobody, we don't call upon we're not going to call upon George Bush to step down from office. He's not going to do it. Those of us who disagree with his world vision, we're not going to do that. We're going to put him out. And, you know, I think ballots are
better. But how do you put him out?
Well, ballots are better than bullets. I'm not an advocate of violence, okay? Mm-hmm. But if you But nonetheless, politics is not about a moral appeal. Politics is about power. And the Civil Rights Movement was a political movement
It seems like, I just want to be sure we say this, because with the making the analogy to President Bush, he got his second term. He will be out after 4 years because there's a time certain of a presidential term. Yeah. But the Civil Rights Movement, it's this, the Civil Rights era, it's this, it's kind of amorphous as to when it's, when it ended.
When it ended and when it started.
Or did it end? Because there are still civil rights cases people talk about to this day.
Well, people say Civil Rights Movement. I always want to say, which one? Because, you know, there was a Civil Rights Movement in the Mississippi Delta and the Delta of the Mississippi River in Arkansas and Mississippi in the 19-teens and 20s, and the governor of Arkansas led federal troops and mowed them down with machine guns and killed over 250 people in one day and put 1,000 others in prison for life or 20 years. And, you know, the president didn't say a word about that, but you know, 50 years later, when the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee got to the Mississippi Delta, things had changed, and and they did the same thing, but were not mowed down because the federal government wouldn't put up with it. You know, structural conditions had changed, and you know, that's not about a moral witness. That's about political reality.
Mm-hmm. We go to the phones right now, and Jim is with us in Rocky Mountain. Hi there, Jim.
Good afternoon. Enjoying your program. I have a question for Tim as to the extent to which mainline Protestant denominations have engaged in what I would call truth and reconciliation processes. I was I grew up in Fayetteville and can recall fairly vividly a minister that indeed in a Presbyterian church, kind of a downtown, you know, church, was ousted. And, you know, I'm wondering the extent to which some truth and reconciliation within those faith communities might, you know, have happened, or is it is anything like that going on in our state?
I think some things like that are going on. People are I've been talking at churches all over North Carolina this fall, and I've found a remarkable receptiveness to talking about the past and about issues of race. When I was coming up, you know, my father's a minister, my five uncles, all Methodist ministers in eastern North Carolina, and of course, most of their friends were ministers, and when they sat around talking shop, and I was a little boy listening, I knew that race was the issue and that you were liable to get fired.
And for talking about it.
For talking about, if you advocated racial equality from your pulpit.
And this is in the 60s.
In the 1960s, you were just taking your job in your hands. And if you're a Baptist, for example, and you were just employed by the individual, I mean, the Methodist ministers at least had the bishop protecting them a little bit, because the institutional church was not never as bad as the local church, but the Baptist minister couldn't say boo, unless he was at Pullen Memorial in Raleigh, couldn't say boo about civil rights, or he'd be out of work before the day was over. And that's, you know, that's just the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about it, though.
About reconciliation.
Yeah.
And there may be many folks who hear that and say, well, why don't we just move on from where we are right now? Why go back over that? Because we got to this point, whether it was through violence, nonviolence, a combination of the two, an emphasis on one over the other. Things are far better now than they were in 1955 America. So why go back? And why go over that?
Well, because we don't get up every morning and roll out a blueprint and say, geez, Melinda, how would you like the world to be? You know, what we do is we wake up in the same world we went to bed in. And if we're going to make that world different by the end of the day, you know, then we're going to have to do that out of who we are. And who we are is a function of who we have been. So we have nothing to call upon except our internal resources and the Lord. And we can't, so we have to get a handle on who we are and who we have been in order to go forward. Ms. Chavis up in Oxford was telling me the other day, she said, well, it's like the rearview mirror on your car. You know, you wouldn't want to just stare in it all the time, but that wouldn't be safe. But if you don't look in it at all, that's not safe either.
Right. Looking in that rearview mirror of what brought change about, if overt armed revolution had been the approach from the start, mm-hmm. It strikes me that if African Americans were in the minority in this country, they'd be very much on the losing side.
Would have gone very badly.
So you did need the
nonviolence. That was the brilliance of nonviolence, was that But nonviolence also depended upon the fact that it wasn't really politically feasible to slaughter the civil rights movement as had been done in the past. Mm. Right? Sure, people got killed, but it wasn't really safe to just murder them wholesale.
Like you just described.
Like happened. I just described, like it happened in the teens and 20s. And it happened at the turn of the century. Here in North Carolina, we had the Wilmington Massacre of 1898. And the conservatives overthrew the government and waded in blood to take power and then took the vote away from black people at the turn of the century. But that was not politically feasible. And black Southerners understood the world they confronted. They knew that that was not feasible. They protected themselves. Most people in the civil rights movement, no matter who you, Rosa Parks and Fannie Lou Hamer and anybody you want, most people kept guns and protected them their homes when they had to. They knew there would be terrorism against them, and there was. It was mostly unsuccessful. But they also knew that, you know, it's one thing to go downtown on Sunday afternoon with the TV cameras running and get hit in the head and have police dogs sicked on you. You don't want to do that. And you're not in the habit of accepting that kind of brutality against yourself, but it's politically effective, and it was. And so that was the genius of nonviolence.
We'll continue our conversation with Tim Tyson. We're talking about how the country remembers the civil rights movement. Tim Tyson is the John Hope Franklin Senior Fellow at the National Humanities Center, and his recent book, Blood Duns Sign My Name, is now a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. It's about the murder of a black Vietnam vet in the town of Oxford, North Carolina, in 1970. We get to more of your calls. Is there a rosy hue put on our memory of the civil rights days? More of your calls at 1-877-962-9862, just ahead on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. February, of course, is Black History Month, but it is also a month during which several significant events in the history of racial equality took place right here in North Carolina. In 1960, February 1960, there were the Greensboro sit-ins. There was also Martin Luther King speaking in that month of February 1960 on the steps of the White Rock Baptist Church, publicly endorsing for the first time that concept of sitting in. And then in February of 1971, there was the infamous Wilmington 10 case breaking out, February of 1971. And so this hour on The State of Things, we're talking about how the civil rights movement is remembered. With us is Tim Tyson. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is author of Blood Duns Sign My Name. It has been chosen as the reading selection for incoming students at UNC Chapel Hill this fall. It's an account of the murder of a black man in Oxford, North Carolina, where Tim Tyson was a 10-year-old at the time, back in 1970, and how the town reacted to that. Tim Tyson is also giving a public lecture this Thursday at the National Humanities Center in Research Triangle Park. The title of that lecture is Miss Amy's Witness, Why the History of the Civil Rights Movement is Mostly All Wrong. We're taking your calls this hour. The number is 1-877-962-9862. Well, Tim Tyson, we've been talking about how the conventional memory and history of the civil rights movement is Martin Luther King said, we want these things, we're going to achieve it through nonviolence, and boom, civil rights happened the next day. And you're suggesting that the threat of force, the actual acts of violence were part of the civil rights era, too, and that part gets overlooked.
Well, it's not the kind of history we want to live with, but it's the kind of history we did live through. And so sometimes I think we look at these rosy depictions of Martin Luther King as a kind of black Santa Claus, genial and vacant, whatever, you know, a kind of Chamber of Commerce civil rights movement that we get in January often. And we don't know how we got where we are from there. That's not a history that logically leads into a nation as deeply divided about race as we are.
Well, let's talk a little bit about one of those events, because we have often discussed on this program, and I think people have heard about it elsewhere, the Greensboro sit-ins of February 1960. February 1971, 34 years ago this month, there was a boycott among African Americans in Wilmington over racial desegregation of the schools.
Yes.
And there were fire bombings, there were gunshots fired, there were two white people killed. And then there were nine African-American men and one white woman who became known as the Wilmington 10 who were prosecuted in that case.
Yes.
They're the Wilmington 10. Why is that case important in the civil rights movement?
Well, the Wilmington, we came from Oxford, where Ben Chavis was from, and he became a civil rights leader there. We moved, my family moved to Wilmington at the same time Ben Chavis did. And so I was in those schools when integration came to Wilmington. And there were, I was in riots. There were two people killed at the school I went to in the ninth grade, not counting the two you mentioned. There were other people killed as well, including a young black man, Steve Corbett, was killed the same night that the other two. But anyway, we had National Guard troops in the streets. We had the police in the schools at the high school. We had, I saw people fighting with bricks and bottles and chains and knives.
What did you do yourself in that case?
Ran. I got beat up from time to time. I got hit in the head with a padlock on a boy was swinging on a chain, actually, which may explain a lot of things. But, you know, it was bad. And then eventually the school authorities kind of got us together, and there were people working in the community trying to calm things down, and we think we did better. But it was a very, very tumultuous process. Wilmington had such a bitter history. Wilmington had been the center of black economic and political power in North Carolina and the biggest city in the state when white conservatives overthrew the government of the state, essentially killed a lot of people in Wilmington.
In 1898.
100 years, you know, ago. And then, but that massacre lived on in the minds of black Wilmingtonians and had everything to do with what happened in 1971. And then there was a group down there called the Rights of White People that had a paramilitary group that could put about 750 men on the street with trucks. The chief of police once told me that, believe it or not, the Ku Klux Klan was a moderating influence in Wilmington in the early 1970s, that the Rights of White People were really out there. So we had those people. We had the Church of the Black Messiah downtown on Castle Street in Wilmington, where there was kind of a black revolutionary church. Anyway, we had snipers downtown. You didn't go downtown in those days. Wilmington's come a long way.
There's an account in your book, Blood Doesn't Sign My Name, where your dad, the white Methodist minister, he makes sure he's wearing his collar this one day as he's walking down Castle Street, because he's walking a gauntlet between the white militia and the black militants. And he's going to pay a visit to Ben Chavis.
Yes.
And he's trying to be a moderating influence. And one gets the impression from your writing that he didn't hold sway. Your dad was lamenting that the language of war had taken over.
Well, by 1971, that political space that he was trying to occupy didn't exist anymore. And, you know, of course, he had been trying to do that for a long time. And, but yeah, he, you know, my father was put his life on the line and put his chips on the table and did what he thought he ought to do. But it didn't work out so well. The next time they talked, Ben Chavis was in prison.
Right, because he was among the Wilmington Ten, and
yes,
they were in prison until 1980
yes,
when it was overturned. We're talking today about how we remember the history of civil rights in the country and here in North Carolina. Karen Bethea Shields is an attorney in Durham, and 30 years ago, she was a lawyer for Joanne Little. Joanne Little was a black female prisoner accused of murdering a white prison guard in Beaufort County. Karen Bethea Shields, thanks for talking with us today.
Hello.
Hi. Well, the case of Joanne Little may be news to many people in North Carolina today, but back in the mid-70s, this was a huge story. A white prison guard murdered in Joanne Little's prison cell. She said she killed him because he had tried to rape her. And for you, this was an important civil rights case in 1974.
Yes, it was important. It was my first case that I got. I just found out I had passed the state bar. I'd always been teased by my law partners that my first case was going to be a first-degree murder case. They were teasing, but in fact, it had been the very first case. It was important to me because there had been a lull in the civil rights community on anything that the entire nation could agree upon. You had local civil rights groups doing things, but this was a national case because people looked at Joanne Little and found issues that appealed to them, such as the criminal justice system, feminism, issues against rapists, all those things, and poverty and feminism. So people looked at this case and rallied around Joanne Little.
It sounds almost like a branching out of civil rights, no longer being only about achieving rights for African Americans, but in those other areas that you just described.
That's correct. The National Organization for Women was very instrumental in rallying around Joanne Little, looking at issues that affected women in general, and specifically those people that they wanted to advocate for. The old civil rights groups rallied around because they saw issues that affected African Americans in the community across the nation. Joanne Little was a typical prisoner, young, black, female, poor. She was someone that people could look at it and get out issues that had been not talked about, and even after her case, still are not talked about like they should, such as racism.
There is also the case of the Wilmington 10 back in 1971. Well, I imagine you were still in law school. What do you remember about that case?
Well, the Wilmington 10 case, I remember meeting Ben Chavis when I was in school. This was an issue, a case where young people could rally behind a civil rights issue, because no longer did we have the Dr. Kings coming into town. We saw the issue of racism. We saw the issue of unequal education, and we saw these young people as trying to make sure that our system worked like it should work. I remember the protests. I remember the sort of the trials involved with the Wilmington 10, and they became our heroes. Wilmington 10 became our heroes in the civil rights movement at that time.
Mm. And the civil rights case that you saw in the Wilmington 10, was it that these people were wrongly accused? What was the case for them?
We saw that they were wrongly accused, that they were trying to do something to help the community in Wilmington, and they were wrongly accused. We saw the criminal justice system working ineffectively and trying to prosecute those people that were really out to try to help the community in Wilmington. And those issues of racism and injustice came out in that particular case, as so with Joanne Little.
Right. Timothy Tyson has been making the case with us this hour that the history of the civil rights movement is somewhat sanitized. That's a word he uses in a speech he's going to be giving this week. Do you agree or disagree with that? And if so, why?
Sort of disagree with that, but in a lot of parts I agree with it, because our society likes to hide his head in the sand. We don't want to deal with hard issues like racism, like injustice. We'd rather just kind of go over it and not look at it in depth. It's easier for us to look at the good parts of the civil rights movement and not figure out what happened when local people got their heads beaten in trying to have their children go to schools. It's not comfortable for us. We are a comfortable society. And so, therefore, since a lot of African Americans don't write their own history, we're an oral people, a lot of our history will not be as correct as it should be. And since we don't control the media, a lot of the times we don't get out exactly what happened. So in many senses, it is sanitized, and it's sanitized for a reason. And the reason is we don't really want to get to the heart of why things happen the way they happen and how we can improve it.
Well, Karen Bethea Shields, you went on to become a judge. You're an attorney now. Do you know what ever happened to Joanne Little?
The last time I heard, she was in New York. She was doing okay. She did not get in trouble again. She was 19 at the time that the offense happened. The sad part about the Joanne Little case for her personally, even though she was found not guilty, was the fact that because she got so much national, international attention, she was not able to really exercise the talent that she had. People just saw her as one thing, as an inmate who had got in trouble. They did not see the creativity and the talent that she had. And so that was the sad part about her case. The good part was that some people, many people, were able to see the injustice in our criminal justice system and the fact that if you have a lot of money and support, that you can make the system work for you.
Well, Karen Bethea Shields, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Karen Bethea Shields is an attorney in Durham, and she represented Joanne Little in that case. It was quite controversial and very much in the news in North Carolina in the mid-1970s. We're talking with Tim Tyson, author of Blood Done Sign My Name, about how we remember the civil rights movement. And with us is Matt in Greensboro. Hi there, Matt.
Hi. How are you doing?
Welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm calling because I am 22. I'm in Greensboro, recent graduate of Guilford College, and I grew up in rural North Carolina. And I didn't learn a lot about North Carolina's civil rights history until I went to college. And even then, it was not really in my classes, but through friends that were activists and things like that. And right now, Greensboro is kind of in a state of change. You've got the Greensboro Truth and Reconciliation Commission that's getting started up right now to address the Greensboro Massacre in 79, and the Civil Rights Museum is getting ready to open up. And me and my friends have been discussing this kind of like what we've been noticing is a pattern of appropriation when it's or you appropriate the these symbols like the ANT4, which are now called the Greensboro 4, who started the sit-in movement when it's safe and or profitable. And now the Greensboro Chamber of Commerce, like signs that are hung in businesses, have the ANT4 on there. And
do you think there would ever be a day when the those people that were involved in the shootings in Greensboro in 1979, the showdown between Klan and some communists and others in Greensboro, do you think that they would ever be memorialized that way in Greensboro?
No, because and the museum doesn't want to include, I guess, like, or put a major focus on the events of 79 or 69 at ANT when the National Guard came in and shot up the campus and stuff like that, because they say they don't want to have violent encounters, I guess, documented or focused on.
I'm going to put your comments, Matt, to Tim Tyson.
Well, I think our friend makes a real good point. You know, I think what we really want to do is have a kind of celebratory history that's comfortable and digestible and even saleable, you know. Honestly, people want to have civil rights tourism. You know, I think that he said that very well, that you know, the messier parts of things don't get told. And, you know.
Could it be that... I'm trying to think. There are times when we certainly celebrate or we have historical markers talking about wars that have taken place on our soil. You know,
well,
historical markers.
Absolutely.
But we wouldn't do it about this because is it too recent?
Well, it's too recent and it's too divisive. And, you know, this we talk about the Civil War as if it were uncontroversial. You know, the Confederates hanged 22 local boys down in Kinston. They hanged them. 22. That's a lot of boys in Kinston. They killed basically all the young men in Kinston because they were against the Confederacy. Lots of people in North Carolina were against the Confederacy. You know, thousands and thousands. And yet it's presented as though the South did this, North Carolina did that, when in fact there was always contention and, you know, a lot of disagreement and even violence. And, you know, things get kind of swept under the rug. So I think there's a difference between a real honest historical approach and a kind of civic celebration that so often passes for history when it really doesn't matter.
I asked earlier when Mel Watt was on the program at the top of the hour whether he had hoped for something, and he gave me a new way to phrase a question, so I'm going to ask, do you have a realistic hope that that would change?
I do. I think, for example, in Sanford, the church where everything went so well and Miss Amy spoke and everybody's hearts were changed, I can't get in that church. But in Oxford, where we really essentially got run out of town, that church had me back for a reading recently. The city of Oxford had me to speak at the high school. 500 people, about half black, half white, showed up. The city bought everybody dinner. We had a real good conversation. So there are people who are trying to deal with this. Wilmington itself has done a great job 100 years later of, as a community, confronting its own history in a realistic way. So I think North Carolina has shown a lot of promise in this field.
Well, Tim Tyson, thanks for being with us again
today. Thank you so much, Melinda.
Tim Tyson is author of the book Blood Done Sign My Name. He'll give a speech on the history of the civil rights movement as he sees it this Thursday, February 17th at 5 at the National Humanities Center in Research Triangle Park. That's the State of Things for today. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.